Hi, this is Pete Fornital with the Crawdaddy Rock Review, produced in association with the editors of Crawdaddy Magazine and presented by Discwasher, makers of ultimate record care equipment. Stay tuned for a fast hour of music, news, and interviews. On this edition of the Crawdaddy Rock Review, we'll feature two great stars who have embarked on solo careers. Kenny Loggins, who'll talk about his new career as well as his performing days with Jim Messina. And Rick Derringer, who'll tell us about the McCoys of Hang On Sloopy fame, his days with Johnny and Edgar Winter, and his current solo activities. We'll also have our regular nonsense facts, comedy classics, and music reviews. We'll start with a listen to Dolly Parton as the Crawdaddy Rock Review continues. And now the Crawdaddy Rock Review gives you a capsule summary of thoughts and reactions to a brand new album release. Dolly Parton is now a certified pop culture icon who has transcended her country music origins for mass appeal on magazine covers, in gossip columns, and TV appearances. Release of her new album, Here You Come Again, is certain to be Parton's biggest push for musical acceptance outside the country field. Dolly's first bid for the crossover market, the New Harvest album, brought such howls of outrage from her faithful fans that she actually took out ads in music trade papers denying she was deserting those who made her a star. With Here You Come Again, the furor is bound to erupt anew. It clearly falls in the zone where soft country merges with pop.
Here you come again, just when I've begun to get myself together. You waltz right in the door, just like you've done before, and wrap my heart round your little.
The title track lilts along as if it never heard of Nashville, with only the barest touch of pedal steel to remind us of Dolly's roots. The emphasis here is on piano, strings, and acoustic rhythm guitar. Recorded in Hollywood, and it shows.
Oh, oh, baby, won't you come out tonight? We'll run up the hill and we'll dance in the moonlight. Let me gaze into your eyes till we both go blind. Oh, baby, can I see you tonight? There won't be no more sleeping over on a Tuesday night. No more running to the races for a dark horse at midnight. No more dancing after hours, singing in the shower, or clinging to each other in the soft morning light.
Four of the 10 songs here are Parton compositions, ranging from the aggressive to the almost unbearably sentimental.
Before I could say a word, she said, "My name is Sandy, and this here is my puppy, you got no gingerbread, ain't you got no candy.
But two doors down stands out as the funkiest cut of the whole.
Two doors down, they're laughing and drinking and having a party. Two doors down, they're not aware that I'm around. Here I am, crying my heart out, feeling sorry, but they're having a party just two doors down. Lying across my lonely bed in this lonely old apartment,
Here You Come Again is a slick pop product. While country music fans may accuse her of selling out, the editors of Crawdaddy magazine believe that Dolly's onto something.
Phonograph records are invaluable items for the musical enjoyment and the excellent sound they provide. The Discwasher record cleaning system helps you preserve both the value and the sound of your record library. The beautiful walnut handle is the first thing you'll notice, but it's Discwasher's patented directional microfibers and unique D3 fluid that safely frees your records of dust and fingerprints. D3 fluid has unequaled cleaning activity, but does not harm the important vinyl additives used by record manufacturers to prevent deterioration. Only Discwasher uses a fluid designed for both thorough cleaning and safety to vinyl. You'll find cheaper copies, but there's only one Discwasher at fine audio centers and record stores everywhere. Or write to Discwasher Incorporated, 1407 North Providence Road, Columbia, Missouri, 65201.
This is Pete Fornatel back on the Crawdaddy Rock Review presented by Discwasher. My guest this segment is a newcomer to music, has his first solo album out. A couple of people have recorded his songs. What was your name again?
Ken Loggins.
Oh, Kenny Loggins. Yes. Kenny Loggins.
You can call me Ken.
Pardon the facetious introduction, mm-hmm. Ken, but in a real sense, this mm-hmm. is a new start for you, is it?
Very
not?
Much so, very much so. This was in order to make a step forward, you have to take a couple back sometimes, and this was an important step forward for me. And in a way, it's a couple steps back too, because at the end of the Loggins and Messina career, we were headliners, headlining Madison Square Garden and a number of other places that would sometimes 50,000 people. When I started performing as Kenny Loggins, the soloist, I found myself as an opening act for Fleetwood Mac. And right back at the beginning, playing to audiences that didn't even know I was on the bill.
What was that like?
At times frustrating, but always fulfilling, because by the end of the show, I think I made a lot of new friends. I would time my set so that I did the recognizable Loggins and Messina things, meaning Danny's song, House of Pooh Corner, love song. Somewhere just before the middle of my show, they gave me a full hour. And so when the people were just about seated, when the house was getting just about full, I'd go into these tunes and they'd all go, wait a minute. I could see people going, nobody said he was on this show. What is this? And all of a sudden, from that point on, it got rolling and we'd get a really strong reaction every time with them.
Is it ego damaging? Is it
no, it's very
humbling?
It's very good for your head to play this way, because I don't go out with any preconceived notions of how terrific I'm going to be or how great these shows. I know that I have to work very, very hard every show. And it was really good for me and it was really good for my band.
Was it getting stale in the last days of Loggins and Messina?
Well, yes. Yes and no. We worked hard at keeping that from happening, but to a degree, it had to get stale, especially since Jimmy and I had talked it over in 76 and decided in January to go our separate ways, yet we both wanted to fulfill our commitments to the promoters and to our audience. and to ourselves.
Was there a precise moment, Kenny, when you knew that the decision was irreparable, that you would go out on your own?
I knew it way before we talked about it. I knew it in my stomach, I knew it in my heart, that the time had come. Nothing is irreparable, nothing is unchangeable.
Let's get that straight right here. The door is open to a musical reunion somewhere down the road. Is that not so?
To this point, the way I feel is this, that if at any time Jimmy were to come in, if I had a song that I felt was right for Jimmy Messina to play guitar on or even to sing on, I would bring him in to join me on a recording. But I foresee no reunion of Loggins and Messina as a performing act.
Ah.
And I would go so far as to say that I foresee no reunion of Loggins and Messina as a recording act, but I may play on one of his songs on his record, or he's welcome to play on one of mine on any record that I make, if the song calls for it, if the feelings are right.
For Jimmy's fans, and they are legion, can you give us some idea of what he's up to these days?
Jimmy recently sold his famous ranch in Ojai,
right,
the Motherlode Ranch.
Right.
And he's selling a lot of his possessions in an effort to simplify his life. He's living on a sailboat off the coast of Santa Barbara. But Kenny Loggins is a solo act on his own, working his butt off to make Celebrate Me Home a successful album and to make my career, to launch a beginning of a strong career. I want to see how far this can go as myself.
And Celebrate Me Home is a successful album. What hopes did you have for it when it was released, and has it equaled or exceeded those hopes yet, Kenny?
It has exceeded the hopes
great.
That I had. My hopes were that it would go gold. I felt very strongly that it had a lot of good chances, a lot of good programming chances as far as what could be played on the air. I felt that it was the best record that I could have made at that time in my life, and that I'd fulfilled creatively what I wanted to do. And there's not much more you can ask for.
And since today is the day that you are presented a gold record for Celebrate Me Home, we know that part of the goal has been achieved.
It's already gone, in the last 2.5-3 weeks, it's already gone way past gold and well on its way to platinum, knock on wood.
Is there a track on the solo album that stands out above the rest for you, Kenny?
Well, it depends on the level that you're talking about. For me, musically, the song that I think will hang around the most is the title tune, Celebrate Me Home.
Let's take a break here and listen.
Home for the holidays. I believe I've missed each and every face. Come on and play one easy. Let's turn on every love light in the place. It's time I found myself totally surrounded in your circles. Oh, my friend. I can sing me home. Uneasy highway, traveling where the westerly winds can fly. Somebody tried to tell me, but the man forgot to tell me why. I gotta count on being gone. Come on, mama. Come on, let it be what you want to be. I'm this town, I'll be. Please celebrate me home.
That is Celebrate Me Home, the title track from the first solo album by Kenny Loggins. In a sense, you were starting out to do a solo album half a dozen years ago and got sidetracked. Isn't that the truth?
That's right. Very pleasantly sidetracked, too.
How did it happen?
I had made up my mind in 1970 that I wanted to finally be a performing artist and a recording artist. I'd been a writer for a couple years, and I'd put together a bag full of tunes that I was very proud of. Some of those tunes are Danny's Song, House of Pooh Corner, Love Song, Longtail Cat. And I felt that I wanted to start meeting producers, and I finally met the right producer, and that was Jimmy Messina.
Were you aware of his previous successes as a
very much
musician?
So, yeah. His Buffalo Springfield credit was the one I was most concerned about, because it seemed like the right kind of ear for the sort of thing I wanted to do. We started trading tunes. One of the first tunes that he showed me was a song of his called Peace of Mind, which was originally intended to be on the solo album sung by me, but a Jimmy Messina tune.
Okay.
But that tune led to showing me other tunes of his, and he showed me Golden Ribbons, which didn't go on Sittin' In, but went on a later album. And I said, Jimmy, you should really be doing these yourself. How come? And he said, well, the bands I were in, they kind of, you know, discouraged me from singing, and they didn't think that I had a good voice. And I said, well, that's crazy. You know, so we, in essence, I was becoming his producer, and he was becoming my producer, and we both lifted each other to a place where we made the Sittin' In album. We shared that album spontaneously from about the second week of our lives together on. One thing led to another, and the success of that album led to the formal making of a duo, which we called Loggins and Messina, the second album. And from there, we put in six very strong, hard-working, profitable years for us.
The first album was something of a sleeper, right? I mean,
it was the ideal album as far as watching an album grow. It grew over years. Some albums, like the second album, for example, jumped on the charts, and within like 3 weeks, it was up top 20, and within 8 weeks, it's back down in the 50s or 60s, and in a few months, it's gone. Sittin' In went on the charts very, very slowly in the hundreds, and it took 2 years for it to fulfill its complete course. And it was the first album to go platinum, and Celebrate Me Home seems to be following that course. It's come on very gently in the lower numbers and moving up very steadily, and increase of sales and all the things.
Did it bother you when a Loggins and Messina album did not do as well as its predecessors had?
One did bother me very much. The Mother Lode album did not do as well as its predecessors, and I think it was the finest album we ever made.
How do you explain it?
I think it was a departure, musical departure for us. I think the people wanted to hear more of Danny's Song, more of the trilogy type things, more Peace of Mind type material. And we were beginning to get a little funkier in our styles, or attempting to get a little funkier. Our music was changing, our styles were changing, our chords were getting more sophisticated. And I think we left a number of people behind, and we both looked at each other before the release of that album and said, we're going to lose some of our audience here. And I said, yeah, but maybe we'll gain some, too.
Sure, it's a choice you have to make.
It's time to move on, right?
Yeah. After the fact, did you think that the Oldies album was a mistake?
Yes and no. It was, sales-wise, a mistake, because we discovered through that album that the people wanted to hear original material. They wanted us to write our own material and sing our own material, and they didn't consider Loggins and Messina interpreters of other people's material, at least not old 50s type material. Yet, looking back on it, I can say that it was something we had to get out of our system.
Listen, I have to do something right now that I promised myself I would. In all of the years that I've known you, I did not know until today that you spent a brief time with a rock and roll band of some note from the late 60s. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yes, I do. Okay, let me explain what happened there. He's referring to a band called the Electric Prunes.
Right.
And Electric Prunes was a fabricated act, at least from their second generation on. the manager owned the name. And when the original writers and singers quit the band, they hurriedly reformed a new Electric Prunes with the same bass player and the same lead guitarist, and that was it.
This is bionic rock and roll.
Oh, yeah, those were the days. And a friend of mine named Jeremy Stewart, who was a piano player, was approached by their producer, Dave Hassinger, and said, if you can find me some players to fill in these spaces, you can do the next Electric Prunes tour and make a lot of money, supposedly, in quotes. So he called me up and said, hey, you know, I'd never toured for anybody. I'd never done any professional work at that point in my life. I'd done a little writing. I said, gee, I don't know. As the Electric, we have to do Too Much to Dream and all that? Because I had just written Danny's song, you know, and it didn't exactly relate.
Not quite.
And he said, nope, we get to do our own material. It was a terrible, terrible tour. And the best part is that we had to do that tour without a drummer because the manager threatened to sue us if we didn't do the tour.
All right, how do you explain a hard-driving rock and roll band without a drummer?
Well, you know, the first place we played was in Canada, and we all put on black armbands. This was Mark Tulin's idea, the bass player, who's totally crazy. We put on black armbands and said it was a memorial concert for our recently dead drummer. It didn't go, it kind of threw a black cast over the audience. So in the next place, we came up with some quote from Aristotle where music is its own percussion or something.
In what circumstances do you feel you do your best writing?
Well, two circumstances. One is at home after about a week of unwinding when I start to reach boredom. When I get really bored, then I can re-immerse myself into my own writing. The other place that I do my writing is when the adrenaline is just coursing, and that's before a big important show.
Really?
Like maybe within the hour before I go on, I can find a shower somewhere or a big tiled room of some sort and just pump them out. Sometimes I can write three or four melodies in that hour. A lot of the Celebrate Me Home album was written in showers. Lady Luck, a lot of the melodies were written and a lot of the lyric concepts were written in shower rooms or dressing rooms before shows.
Kenny, congratulations on the gold album that you received today for Celebrate Me Home. We'll be rooting for platinum for you.
Thank you.
Your solo career is well on its way, and thanks for taking time out to visit with the Crawdaddy Rock Review.
Thank you, Pete.
This is Pete Fornital back on the Crawdaddy Rock Review, and it's time now for Crawdaddy's Comedy Classics. An opening monologue, a golf swing, banter with the band, and a nightly roster of celebrity guests. It's a pattern that's worked for 15 years, as millions of Americans have caught the late-night TV habit.
And now, here's Johnny!
Johnny Carson, a certified TV institution, smoothly treads his way through each Tonight Show with glib one-liners, masterful double takes, and an occasional departure as his own guest character, Art Fearn.
Now it's movie time again, and today's classic, Dame Mae Whitty, Jose Iturbe, Leo Carrillo, and Sabu in Mr. Moto Sucks an Egg. Here it is.
Johnny Carson is The Tonight Show, and a real person to about 220 million Americans. His Emmy Awards and impressive guest lists all give a kind of testimony to Johnny Carson's unique art. But it's the living room or bedroom audience themselves that are the final measure of Carson's success. For every countless 5-minute commercial break over the years, they have continued to heed his advice to stay tuned. And now, here's Johnny, caught in a comic situation with guests Dean Martin and Buddy Hackett.
I just dropped in because I come to wish you a happy anniversary, but... It seems to me it's impossible for you to have an anniversary. You've only been married 7 months.
Welcome to the club. Oh.
And I, you know, I watch you every time you're on. What are you on? Tuesdays, Wednesdays?
Tuesdays, Wednesdays. Thursdays.
No, you're not on all those nights. Joey Bishop's on all those nights.
Joey comes in occasionally.
Joey comes in.
Can I disprove something once and for all? They make jokes about you drinking, like I make jokes about Ed. Can I?
That's may I.
May I, excuse me.
You were dangling a participle, and I just found out.
Well, I'll wear a long coat, and nobody will notice it. You ever thought of getting a partner again?
Oh, no.
Come
no,
on.
I tried Linda Lovelace, but she said she had it up to here.
I didn't know that.
But it's sweet of you to come over and wish me... No, I'm glad you're here.
Over here.
It was my pleasure to come here.
And
I don't know why I was... Well, but I do watch you every night.
You were in the building anyway.
No, but it's you. You are something. For 11 years, you have been something. What you are, I don't know. But he's the nicest guy.
What are you... Oh, you're not supposed to be out here.
Come here.
Why don't you taste of his drink? Because it's powerful.
I know what that is.
You, look, you better smarten up because I'll say a few things.
No, don't stop. Don't.
Did you hear what happened with this guy?
I'm afraid
it was a terrific thing. I'm going to try and tell it in a way that they can't bleep it, but I doubt it. See, this guy says that, he says to another guy, he says, every time I sneeze, I have this complete gratification that comes from a way of having connubial fulfillment. He says, you mean every time you sneeze, you have a complete feeling as though you and someone you are closely related with through marriage had experienced many moments of gymnastics? He said, yes. He says, each time you sneeze, he says, what do you take them for it? He said, pepper.
We'll be right back.
Try to bleep that,
after a word from the...
That's it for today's Crawdaddy Comedy Classic. This is Pete Fornatown. And now the Crawdaddy Rock Review gives you a capsule summary of thoughts and reactions to a brand new album release. Eddie Money. This debut album by a former New York City cop might be considered as a nostalgia item. It typifies the structured, three-minute frenzy of early 60s hard rock, when the song was as important as the arrangement. The editors of Crawdaddy magazine find the overall effect powerfully airtight. Rock and roll never forgets. Get up now. Yeah! Eddie Money's voice is a museum piece in itself, conveying the subtle arrogance of rock that is now so often exaggerated by singers with less conviction. It's on liberal exhibition in the insistent wannabe a rock and roll star. Eddie Money manages to bring it all under roaring control for the softer Save a Little Room, which is reminiscent of Terry Reid's best. Jealousy and Gambling Man round out the rockers, while Smokey Robinson's Really Got a Hold on Me receives a fitting tribute. Eddie Money is definitely right on it and ready for the bank. The Crawdaddy Rock Review, presented by Discwasher, now delivers a brief listen to bits of unsettling news and nonsense facts from around the national neighborhood. A 15-year-old boy wearing a wig and woman's clothing successfully freed his 13-year-old brother from a juvenile detention center by pretending he was his mother. A Dallas County spokesman said no one suspected a thing. The older brother simply called the facility, imitated his mother's voice, and said she'd be stopping by in several weeks to take custody of the younger boy. And so, she did. A Portland, Oregon teenager was promptly expelled for punching out a girl at school who pushed a pomegranate in his face. The school principal went to the boy's home and explained that having a fruit pushed in your face wasn't sufficient reason to hit someone. The boy's mother disagreed and decided to demonstrate her point. She went into the house and returned with a nice ripe honeydew melon, which she squashed into his face twice. She reports he left with three seeds on his nose. In a landmark decision, a federal court has ruled that private companies have the legal right to patent new forms of life they create in the laboratory. The court ruled that the Upjohn Company may patent a new microorganism it developed for use in making medicines. The ruling is expected to be cited by companies doing recombinant DNA research. The controversial research enables scientists to change living cells around, producing entirely new forms of plant and animal life. The 19-year-old son of a policeman has been freed by a superior court in Indianapolis on the ground that his arrest for burglary was illegal. The court ruled that when Lieutenant Michael Loran searched his son's room at home and found a stolen stereo, the father had failed to obtain a proper search warrant. In addition, the court said, the policeman had failed to advise his son of his constitutional rights before questioning him. That's it for today's Nonsense News. I'm Pete Fornital.
To a lot of music lovers, static electricity is an enemy. Static charges in a record cause loud pops that can ruin the enjoyment of your music system. You can stop that noise with a Zerostat from Discwasher. Zerostat is the ultimate anti-static device. It looks like a pistol, and with the squeeze and release of the trigger, the Zerostat emits millions of positive and negative ions to neutralize any surface, be it a phonograph record, plastic dust cover, or negatives in a darkroom. So you see, the Zerostat has many uses in fighting static and the dust it always attracts. Zerostat is safe, has no cartridge to replace, and nothing to plug into the wall. Look for Zerostat at Discwasher dealers or write to Discwasher Incorporated, 1407 North Providence Road, Columbia, Missouri, 65201. That's Discwasher Incorporated, Columbia, Missouri, 65201.
This is Pete Fornital, back on the Crawdaddy Rock Review, brought to you by Discwasher, and my guest this segment is Rick Derringer, who has been playing rock and roll for more years than probably he even cares to remember or think about.
I don't even know how many.
How old were you the first time, your first band, Rick?
Well, Hang On Sloopy came out when I was about 17, and that was clear back in 1965, the end of 65, almost 66.
That is, to this day, a classic rock and roll record. Did you know when you were doing it that it was destined to be such a monster?
Well, strangely enough, I didn't. But on the other hand, yeah, everybody knew. It was amazing because the gentleman that was the president of the record company that it was recorded for also wrote the song.
That's Burt Burns. He's no longer living, is that correct?
Right. And he wrote lots of great rock and roll tunes, Twist and Shout, and Little Piece of My Heart and stuff. But he wrote this song. It became number one R&B hit by the Vibrations, so he had a lot of confidence in it. These guys came along called the Strangeloves, who produced records. They produced the first hit for his company, Bang Records. So he had a lot of confidence in them. He said, I got a lot of confidence in Hang On Sloopy, and you guys are going to make it a hit for me. We happened to be playing in Ohio, and these guys, the Strangeloves, were on their tour after their first hit that they produced for Burt, and they were looking for four guys who happened to resemble the Beatles in any way, shape, or form, because it was the beginning of Beatlemania, to do Hang On Sloopy.
Were you, in fact, influenced by the Beatles?
No, but everybody was then. I mean, we were a regular old copy band. We did whatever was the hits of the day to make the kid next door like us even more.
Did you call yourselves the McCoys?
We were first the McCoys, but at this time we were called Rick and the Raiders. We backed, they'd have a kind of scam they ran in those days where they'd bring through recording artists like the Drifters or Chuck Berry, and the promoter would pay them a certain amount of money and wouldn't entail a backup group. But if he could find a backup group in his local area that would open the show for next to nothing and also be good enough to back up this Chuck Berry or Drifters, sure, then he was like getting extra profit for himself. And we were one of those bands. The promoter would say, well, next week we got Chuck Berry. This is an actual story, for instance. Chuck Berry coming in. When I was 16 or 15, I'm not a very big guy now, but I was really little then. And I've never looked very old, so I looked even younger then. So we'd get all their records, and we'd learn all their songs, and we'd have everything down just perfect, as in the case with Chuck Berry. Then Chuck was real, real late for the show, so there was no real chance for a rehearsal. We were already set up, and everybody's going, where's Chuck? Where's Chuck? He finally arrives. Band is brought in to him. He goes, first of all, he was really shocked when he saw us. This is my backup band. You know, he has like a nervous breakdown. And then he goes, well, you guys know my songs? And we said, yeah, we got them all. He goes, okay, here's what you have to do. You watch my foot. When you see it come up in the air and go back down once, you start. And you keep watching that foot. When you see it go up in the air and come down again, you stop.
Oh, great.
Okay, let's go. We went out. That was our rehearsal. We went out, and believe me, we knew every one of his songs from the records. The stuff we played that night, I've never heard in my life. He changed everything. Everything was from some different planet. I mean, I don't know what we did. But it was fun, you know. It was fun doing all that stuff. Everyone was an experience like that.
And suddenly, here you were thrust into this enormous success. I mean, the McCoys were a very big group there for a time, knocking out the hits. There was Hang On Sloopy, and there was Fever. And I remember things towards the end of the McCoys days that I love a lot that never happened, things like Beat the Clock.
Yeah, that was a pretty good song.
Great song.
Beat the Clock. And I think that writer went on to probably write hits, big hits by other artists and stuff.
Were you broken up when the success or the level of success couldn't be maintained there after a while?
It was discouraging to us because we came in from such a high level of enthusiasm and success and such a low level of real knowledge about the recording business. Like I said, the place we came from was not the kind of teacher that even somebody reading a paper like Crawdaddy, for instance, today, our average reader can open up the paper and he knows more about the recording business and the things to look out for and the things to be cool about and the image consciousness and much more about the whole thing that's involved than we knew having Hang On Sloopy in those days. So it left us no place to go but really down, and the more those things happened, the more we became disillusioned with actually our lack of knowledge and the people around us who were supposed to be knowledgeable, their obvious lack of knowledge.
When did you decide to put an end to the McCoys?
There wasn't really a lot of energy coming from within the group, and we were real discouraged by a lot of the managers and things we'd tried. It was a typical show business story. We didn't have much knowledge, so we tried to find the best people, and a lot of times they weren't the best people. So we became very discouraged, and through all this we met Steve Paul, and he became a good friend through letting us work at his club. And we decided that not that the band should end necessarily, but that the band should just stop. It should have no pressures whatsoever, should stop working live, should just have a situation where it can live and play together, write, think, try to come up with maybe a new direction or a new sound for itself, or maybe its real sound for the first time, or just answer a lot of questions. During this period was when I met Johnny and started jamming with him, and we all decided that Johnny's new band and the thing that we were looking for could both be the same thing, and that was the formation of Johnny Winter and sort of the breakup of the McCoys. But in essence, it really was neither, because it became Johnny Winter and three of the McCoys.
Right.
So we both were able to continue pretty much intact.
Did you change your name around this time too, Rick?
Yeah, right at that time. When the first Johnny Winter album came out, it was when I had really decided, well, look, this whole McCoys thing's happened, and we've done 2-3 different record companies, and we've gone through different managers, and I guess I'm in this business as well as being this person, because now I'm going with Johnny. So I said, well, what the heck, you know? I'd often thought of a possible name change. My name's Zeringer. Now, it doesn't sound very hard to say, Zeringer. It seems pretty simple. But when you see it, for some reason, it doesn't look like it sounds or something. So, like, my parents are in a shopping center. They will answer to any page beginning with Z. You know? I still get mail from the government to my house addressed to Rick P. Zellenuger, you know, stuff like that. So I had often thought about it, but it's hard to really come up with a name that feels like you. You got your name, that's you. Zeringer is me. And all of a sudden, one day I said, Derringer. Wow, that even looks like Zeringer. It sounds like Zeringer. It wouldn't feel so weird at all, you know, Derringer. I might just put it on this album just for the heck of it, you know. I can do whatever I want now.
This is Pete Fornitzel with Rick Derringer, and we'll be back in a moment with some of his latest music. This is Pete Fornitzel back with Rick Derringer on the Crawdaddy Rock Review, and just a bit of a cut from his latest LP, Derringer Live, called Let Me In.
Get your $5 jive. Kind of have an hour.
That's Rick Derringer and Let Me In recorded live. You've seen both of the Winters Brothers through years of incredible successes, highs, and lows. What have you learned from some of the things that have happened to them in both their personal and professional lives?
Well, I think they have both taught me lots of things, musically and otherwise. But I think we've all learned things together is the main thing that happened. We've all been able, we've all had the opportunity to learn, really, our own musical identities in a time when maybe we weren't as sure. I might have not been as sure at one time in my musical career when I was working with Johnny or Edgar exactly what, you know, Rick Derringer wanted to play all the time and what kind of music he liked best or could do best. And that might have been why I was doing all those different things. But I think basically we all three learned what we're about, you know. And that was basically that Edgar has a certain kind of music that he feels real comfortable doing and playing, and a certain kind of person that he really likes to be. That's him. He's found out about himself. And Johnny has in his way, and I definitely have in my way. And I think that's what we've all learned.
Isn't there a problem that comes up sometimes? Don't you feel that your musical identity, Rick Derringer, is lost in the shadow of the Winters Brothers at times?
No, I don't, because when I was playing with Johnny and Edgar, I was never in a position where my musical identity should be anything but subordinate to theirs, because it was in a Johnny Winter band or an Edgar Winter band. They weren't Rick Derringer bands. And I was always inserting myself into those situations in exactly that way, in a way where I could be beneficial to them and their music, whether it's writing or production in those days, or helping to arrange stuff or anything.
Could you be happy in just that role?
No. That's why I don't do that anymore. And I think that's why Edgar, for instance, is doing White Trash, and that's why Johnny is playing the blues. And
that's right.
None of us are really doing anything except what we really like to do the best.
Now, you are three albums into the Derringer experience.
Yeah.
Is it going well for you?
Yeah,
are you pleased?
Yeah, really is. I think that's what's going to come of this, you know, of me saying, well, this is what I like to do, and this is what I found out through all those experiences. It's going to show that it isn't necessarily something that you bank your whole life and your whole logic and your whole career on one record or one piece of music at a time. I just like playing this kind of music in general, but the basic thing I'm really devoted to is making that an ongoing thing that doesn't necessarily change its ideals along the way, that just keeps trying to get better and better and develop its own idea and its direction more and more all the time. Led Zeppelin and the Stones and the Who and all those great rock and roll bands from that time, the best of those bands are still around and they're still existing, and the thing that we've liked about them through all these years is that they've kept developing and they've kept changing, and hopefully they've kept getting better and better all the time. And I'd like to be one of those kind of bands. I don't think there are that many of them here nowadays for this time period, and I don't think there are that many new bands with that way of thinking. I think people want to do it for such a quick reason nowadays, and such a flash thing, man. Get this thing together and get the right direction and get the right promotion and the right ads and push it down their throats and we'll make a killing overnight and we'll all retire. And that's not what I'm in it for. I'm in it for a totally different thing.
It has been your life for so long, Rick. You are a writer, a wizard guitarist, a producer, sideman. You front your own group. Which of those roles are you most comfortable with and see doing the longest?
Playing live. Ah. Just playing in front of people. Playing music, singing music, performing for people. It's more than playing or singing. It's a whole experience that happens between people and a person on stage. Too often, I mean, we all go to concerts all the time in search of that magic moment that comes so rarely, you know? And that's one of the things that I feel comfortable doing.
What can we expect next from Rick Derringer?
Well, we're getting ready to record a studio record.
Same personnel?
We got Kenny Aronson, the same bass player. Double A Aronson, the number one bass player in music today.
All right.
And we have some new people. We got a new drummer, Myron Grumbacher, another Ohio person. And I think he's the best drummer to come along. People are going to freak out when they see Myron. It's like Iggy Stooge and Harpo Marx meet the drums. You know, if you can imagine that right away, you know, that conjures up visions. And we got a new guitarist, Mark Cunningham, who I think adds a real strong like presence and energy to the band that we may have had lacking in that area before. And I think we've got a whole new song consciousness that's developed from within the band. I think it's more of the same. We're not going to make no weird changes. But on the other hand, I think the band's growing and getting better, stronger.
Rick, after all these years and all of your experiences, I am knocked out by your enthusiasm. You are a rock and roll veteran, a rock and roll survivor. And
that's right. Long live the living legend.
It's been a pleasure having you on the Crawdaddy Rock Review.
Thank you, Pete.
You've been listening to the Crawdaddy Rock Review with me, Pete Fornital. The Crawdaddy Rock Review is produced by Cinema Sound Limited in association with the editors of Crawdaddy Magazine and presented by Discwasher. Production techniques and engineering by Martin Brooks. Direction by Len Dugo.